All right, good morning. This is BIO-241. It is March 12th. You just finished your second test, and we're going to finish up autonomic nervous system today. We've got maybe a couple slides to look at, and then we'll move on to senses. And let's see, I'll get the grades to you online as soon as possible. Maybe I'll have them graded if you have a lab this afternoon, so don't leave lab early. If you stay the whole time, there's a chance that I'll get your Scantrons back to you today in lab, and then the other group will get it back on Tuesday. But I'll post your grades online as soon as possible. Probably tomorrow sometime. It'll be late, though. I don't think it'll be first thing in the morning tomorrow. Okay, so are there any questions over autonomic nervous system so far? No? Okay, maybe you haven't looked at it yet, but probably knowing all those different receptor types and what they do is a little confusing. That's probably the most confusing thing about the chapter. Most of that chapter is a review from anatomy. But there aren't too many kinds of receptors, right? The adrenergic receptors, you just got what? The alpha-1, and the beta receptors, you got the beta-1 and beta-2, and know some general characteristics of those things. So let's review autonomic nervous system really quickly. The autonomic nervous system, as opposed to what other division of the efferent pathway. What are the two kinds of efferent pathways? You got autonomic, and what's the other kind in contrast to the autonomic? You got somatic. I heard somebody say somatic kind of under their breath. So yes, definitely say it, but say it with a little authority. Somatic, okay? Somatic nervous system. So how many neurons does it take for a somatic motor pathway to go from the central nervous system to effector organ? Just one. And what's the effector organ, or how many effector organs are there for a somatic pathway? There's one, and that is just skeletal muscle, right? Just skeletal muscle is the only effector organ. Now, for an autonomic pathway, how many neurons does it take? It actually takes two, all right? And one is myelinated, one's not myelinated. Which one is myelinated? Oh, somebody said it just right. That's what I wanted to hear. I didn't want to hear the first one and second one. I wanted to hear what? The preganglionic fiber, which is the first one, or the postganglionic, and somebody said, yes, the preganglionic fiber is myelinated. Postganglionic fiber is not myelinated. All right, what are the effector organs for our autonomic nervous system?
Glands.
Glands, cardiac muscle, and smooth muscle. Right, okay. This slide just kind of reiterates the distinction between somatic motor pathway and an autonomic motor pathway. And the autonomic nervous system has how many divisions? It's got two, and they're called sympathetic and parasympathetic. What's the outflow like for the parasympathetic nervous system? How does it leave your central nervous system for para? It is what kind of outflow? Parasympathetic is craniosacral outflow, craniosacral. And for sympathetic, it is thoracolumbar outflow. Right. What's another structure that's unique to the sympathetic nervous system? It's where the ganglia are located. That's a hint. Parasympathetic nervous system does not have chain ganglia. And the chain ganglia are kind of interesting because they look like auxiliary spinal cords outside the vertebral column just for sympathetic activity. Okay. All right, so you should also know the fight, flight, stress nervous system is the sympathetic, and the rest and digest is the parasympathetic. And that, what's the, how would you describe the relationship between parasympathetic and sympathetic? In most cases, it is antagonistic. Yeah, antagonistic to each other. Sometimes they're complementary. I mentioned that last time. All right, there's one exception. There's one outflow. There's one pathway that doesn't have a true postganglionic fiber. And what pathway is that? And is it in the parasympathetic division or the sympathetic division? Because most have what? The preganglionic and the postganglionic fiber. But there's one pathway that only has a preganglionic fiber. The postganglionic fiber has been modified to do something totally different than conduct electrical impulses. Which one is that? That is a part of the sympathetic division, and that is the preganglionic fiber that goes to the adrenal medulla. right? And there it stops. And when it stimulates the adrenal medulla, the cells of the adrenal medulla just automatically release epinephrine and norepinephrine into the blood. They don't carry electrical impulses via nerve fiber. So it's not a true postganglionic fiber. It acts more like what? An endocrine gland as a result. All right, so you should be aware of that. Probably you should be aware of the precursor that's necessary to make dopamine and norepinephrine and epinephrine. Okay. And this is a pretty good figure for you to know. We went over this one last time. All right, so what kind of outflow does this look like to you? Somatic or autonomic? Autonomic. Why did you say autonomic? Because? Yeah, because there's two neurons, right? And there's a ganglia. And the neurotransmitter in every particular case at these ganglia, whether it's parasympathetic or sympathetic, is acetylcholine. What's the receptor type on the postganglionic cell? It's going to be a nicotinic kind of receptor. And in your mind, you should kind of know what kind of receptor is a nicotinic receptor. Is it a G-protein-coupled receptor, or is it just a nice, simple ligand-gated channel? It's a nice, simple ligand-gated channel that opens up and then depolarizes the cell because it's primarily a sodium channel. All right, now the postganglionic fiber for parasympathetic division is going to be releasing, always, acetylcholine, but the effector organ has muscarinic receptors, not nicotinic receptors. And what can you tell me about a muscarinic receptor? It's going to be a G-protein coupled receptor of some kind, and G-protein coupled receptors could be receptors that produce EPSPs or IPSPs depending on the tissue. So acetylcholine can have different effects in different tissues because the receptor types might be different in the different kinds of tissues. And that's definitely true for the sympathetic nervous system as well. The neurotransmitter that is released at least 99% of the time is norepinephrine. But it can have different effects on different tissues because there are different receptors. What are the two major kinds of receptors for the adrenergic system? The two major kinds are alpha and beta. And you have to know something about the alpha ones and the beta ones and the beta twos. Those are the ones that we covered. And that shows this really nicely on the slide right here. The alpha one are stimulatory. They're producing EPSPs. Right, and all of these work through G-protein coupled receptors, just like the muscarinic type over here for the parasympathetic division. All right, and since alpha-1s cause EPSPs, that's going to cause contraction of smooth muscle, that's going to cause vasoconstriction in certain parts of your body. All right, the beta-1 are on the heart. They're stimulatory on the heart. Right, they're going to cause depolarizations on the heart, so that increases the heart rate and contractility of the heart. The beta-2 are inhibitory kinds of G-protein coupled receptors, and they're going to cause relaxation of smooth muscle, which results in, for instance, bronchodilation of the lungs so that you have an easier time breathing under stressful circumstances. So make sure you can label this figure backwards and forwards because it will help you remember these different receptor types. Okay, let me just see how many slides we got. Okay, that's the last slide we're looking at. Okay, all right, so for the parasympathetic division, we were just finishing up the muscarinic type receptors. All right, remember for acetylcholine, the two major kinds are nicotine and muscarin, or muscarinic receptors. Nicotinic receptors, the reason why they're named is because they bind a fairly common chemical, nicotine. Muscarinic receptors bind another kind of chemical that is fairly prevalent. I just heard on the news today somebody poisoned himself. He ate some mushrooms and actually died about a week later. It was a famous person. I forget who it was. All right, so it's not uncommon to hear of somebody poisoning themselves by eating the wrong kind of mushroom. You can't buy the wrong kind in a grocery store, but if you go out walking around in the woods, it's very easy to poison yourself with eating the wrong kind of mushroom. All right, because it blocks the muscarinic receptors. Okay, so here are, these might be exam figures. Here you see the different kinds of receptors, and nicotinic are just ligand-gated channels. All muscarinic receptors are G-protein coupled receptors, so that the G-protein dissociates from the receptor complex and it has to either open or close an ion channel. So if it is going to produce an IPSP, for instance, it might cause the opening of a potassium channel, which will hyperpolarize the effector organ membrane. But if it is a stimulatory or excitatory G-protein coupled receptor channel right here, then there are a couple ways that depolarization can take place. Maybe the G-protein is going to close an already open potassium channel, right? So if it's already open, what's happening to the cell? If it's an open potassium channel, it's going to actually go the other way. Remember, when you open up a potassium channel, what happens? It hyperpolarizes, right? It hyperpolarizes or repolarizes the membrane. So if you close a potassium channel, that's going to go have the opposite effect, which is depolarize. Maybe that's what you meant. Okay, when you close that potassium channel, it will depolarize the membrane. What are other ways that you can depolarize a membrane? By opening, a calcium channel or a sodium channel to allow cations to enter the cell. That's going to produce EPSP. All right, so in this particular case right here, closing potassium is going to produce an IPSP, opening a sodium or calcium channel, that's going to also produce an EPSP. So you can see two different effects right here. So we do name some different muscarinic receptors by their activity, right? So you got nicotinic. Where do we find nicotinic receptors? On all skeletal muscles, right? All skeletal muscles use only acetylcholine and only the nicotinic type. So when acetylcholine is released on a skeletal muscle, it is always going to produce what? Always. EPSPs. And the neuromuscular junction is huge and extensive. So whenever a somatic motor neuron releases acetylcholine within a neuromuscular junction, that's always going to cause that muscle to contract. All right. Nicotinic receptors are also found in all autonomic ganglia, right? Whether it's sympathetic or parasympathetic, it doesn't matter. And then there are some regions for muscarinic receptors like smooth muscles and glands, M3, class M3 and M5. These cause depolarization and stimulate contraction of smooth muscle, secretion from glands, for instance. By activating G-protein coupled receptors, and that opens calcium channels on, in particular, smooth muscle. So calcium enters that smooth muscle and it's going to cause some proteins within the smooth muscle to shorten. Or, we haven't talked about that yet, it's going to actually cause those proteins to slide over each other, which is going to make the muscle cell smaller. The muscle cell is going to contract. But let's reserve that discussion until we get into muscles. The M2 kind of receptor is what we find in the heart. It's going to have an opposite effect compared to the M3 and 5. This receptor is going to cause hyperpolarization. All right, so what's that going to do to the heart? It's going to slow the heart rate down, right? So that's a nice clear antagonistic effect compared to what kind of adrenergic receptors are on the heart again? It's a beta. Which one? It's a beta 1 receptor on the heart, right? Beta 1 increase the rate of contraction and force of contraction. The M2 muscarinic receptor, right, just slows the heart rate down, but it doesn't affect contractility one way or the other, because the ventricle of the heart doesn't contain any muscarinic receptors, only the conducting and the nodal tissues of the heart. All right, so when I say ventricular myocardium, do you all know what I'm talking about? What's a ventricle of a heart? It's a chamber. It's a chamber of a heart, right? And it's the lower chambers, and it's the thick chambers that pump most of the blood. Okay. All right, so those are the kinds of receptors that you have to become familiar with for the parasympathetic nervous system. Okay, where they're located, what their effect is. All right, so how can, in one tissue, acetylcholine cause an EPSP, and in another tissue cause an IPSP? Because it depends on the receptor channel complex that is there, right? And so we actually have to classify them, give them different names. Okay. All right, so that's it for autonomic nervous system. If in the book it doesn't describe the anatomy well enough for you to see what's going on, then you got to break open your anatomy books and relearn your autonomic nervous system. Okay? Make sure you know the preganglionic fibers and postganglionic fibers. Okay. All right, so now this is kind of a fun chapter where you'll learn some twists to the usual kind of physiology as well that you've learned so far, but I think it will make sense. All right, so we're going to talk a little bit about sensory receptors and then move on to special senses, in particular, then hearing, and then vision later on. Okay, so sensory receptors. You've had some labs already for senses, I believe. All right, so you might be aware of some of this stuff. Transduce is a word that means to change, all right, to change one form of energy into another form of energy. So it's going to change maybe light energy into a kind of energy that your brain understands. What kind of energy does your brain understand? Electrical, that's right. It understands electrical energy. And in what form is that electrical energy? How does a brain communicate? Or how do neurons communicate with each other? Between neurotransmitters. So between each other, if it's a chemical synapse, it's a neurotransmitter. Right, but within a neuron, what is it? What's the signal like? Yeah, it's electrical, and in particular, it's an action potential. Right, and if you were to listen to an action potential, what would it sound like? It's just a blip. It's just a very, very short kind of signal. Right, just I can't remember how many milliseconds it is, maybe a millisecond, and always has a constant amplitude, constant width, but it's just a blip. All right, so sensory receptors change one kind of energy into what? Action potentials, or into these little blips. All right, so that's the job of a sensory receptor, is to transduce environmental energy or information into action potentials, which is the common language of the nervous system. All right, and each kind of receptor responds to a particular modality of energy. Some respond to sound, some respond to light, like... what kind of receptors respond to light? Photoreceptors. Yeah, and you have those in your eye, for instance. So if somebody shines a flashlight in your ear, you won't hear anything, right? Or you won't see anything because you don't have the proper kind of receptor in your ear. All right, so different modalities are perceived, not necessarily because of the receptors that are stimulated, but because of where those receptors are connected into the brain. So different parts of the brain will then give you the perception of different modalities. All right, so for instance, receptors of the eye are connected only to one part of the brain. Does anybody know from anatomy what part of the brain is responsible for vision? Okay, that is the occipital lobe, way in the back. And the lobe of the brain responsible for hearing are the temporal lobes. So if we artificially stimulate the occipital lobe, what is your perception going to be? Okay, if we stimulate that part of the brain with something hot, are you going to feel hot or temperature? No, you're going to experience some kind of visual episode. Or if we stimulate the temporal lobe, again, maybe with temperature, what are you going to experience? You're not going to experience temperature, you're going to experience sound. All right, so the modality that comes to your consciousness depends on what region of the brain is stimulated. And receptors are automatically, through development, connected up to the proper regions of the brain. So the retina, which receives or has the proper receptors for light, are connected to the occipital lobe so that you can perceive light. Okay, sensory receptors. Oh, I thought I deleted this slide. All right, you can delete that one. This slide I like. You should maybe know some different kinds of receptors. Chemoreceptors are sensitive to levels of different kinds of chemicals. So, for instance, you might have chemoreceptors that can monitor hydrogen ion concentration. So they're going to be what? They're going to be pH receptors, or receptors that can monitor CO2 in your body. Those are all chemical receptors. You might have receptors also that can sense, for instance, glucose, maybe on your tongue or in your nose, and that will give you the perception of sweetness or the smell of something sweet. Okay. Photoreceptors transduce light, and you know where those are. Where are those? You have them all over your body? Yes? Okay. That's good. I caught that. I'm awake. You're kidding me. Okay. No, you only have them in two locations, right? Photoreceptors. All right. Now, what about thermoreceptors? These will monitor temperature changes. And now, where do you have these? You have these in your skin, and you have these all over your body, right? Okay. So we're going to make another distinction between receptors on that basis. Mechanoreceptors respond to stretching or deformation of a cell membrane. We're going to see a number of different kinds that do this. For instance, there are receptors on your integument that can monitor vibration or pressure, light pressure, or even deep pressure. Those are mechanoreceptors. Nociceptors respond to some obnoxious or damaging kind of stimulus. It could be maybe a strong acid that's placed on your skin that is denaturing proteins that are on your body, burning your body, right? So those are going to be pain receptors. And then proprioceptors signal positional information in your body. And proprioceptors you have all over in all of your skeletal muscles and all of your joints. So even with your eyes closed, you know basically where all your body parts are. So if I were to walk up to somebody and say, close your eyes and give me your arm, and if I were to, should we try this? Let's try this. Who can I reach? I can reach you easily. See, there's always Jeopardy sitting in the front row. Okay, close your eyes. You mind having me grab hold of your hand and putting it someplace? Okay, so just relax. So where's your hand at?
Above my head.
Above your head. Okay, you get an A. Perfect. So even with your eyes closed, you know where your body is because you have receptors on all the muscles that send information to the cerebellum as to the length and the stretch and the tension. There are receptors in joint capsules which tell angulations of various joints. So you know where all the different parts of your body are. So proprioceptors are where? In just one or two locations in your body or all over the place? All over the place, right? Yeah. There are thermoreceptors in the hypothalamus. I don't think they give you the conscious sensation, maybe, of temperature, but in the hypothalamus, there is the set point for what your normal body temperature should be, which is 98.6. So that's the integration center for body temperature. So if your body temperature varies above or below that, then there's an error signal, and the hypothalamus then can signal other reflexes like sweating or vasoconstriction to bring your body temperature back to the set point. Yeah. Yeah, they have to be thermoreceptors because they're actually measuring temperature. Yeah, inside your body. Why did you get gypped out of some points in lab or something? Or no? Okay. Yeah. No, there's thermoreceptors, but for instance, if somebody were able to put an ice cube on your hypothalamus, you probably wouldn't have the perception that it's cold. But if someone were to put an ice cube on your back, you know for sure that it's a cold, right, that's being placed on you. So it's a different kind of sense. Yeah. Okay. All right, so this is a good way to break down sensory receptors if we're going to organize them. We can organize them or categorize them according to location in your body. All right, so I call receptors general receptors if you have them pretty much all over your body. All right, so if we took an ice cube and put it on your ear, could you tell that was cold? If we put it on the back of your knee, could you tell it was cold? Yeah, right, or on your elbow or anywhere. You have thermoreceptors everywhere, so that's a general sense because you have that general sense all over. What about pain? Can you detect pain? Like if someone were to take a pen and jab you someplace? Yeah, you can tell if somebody jabbed you in the ear, on the chin, or on your kneecap, or whatever. Right? So if there's a particular receptor that is all over your body, we call that a general sense. All right? So what would be a general sense? Temperature would be general, pain, vibration, touch. Proprioception. That's another perfect example. A lot of students, I think, get that confused because proprioception is such a esoteric kind of word, but it's still a general sense, and it's a general sense why? Because it's all over your body, okay? As opposed to a special sense. A special sense means that you have that ability to transduce some form of energy into action potentials only in one or two locations in your body, right? And so what are some senses that you can only perceive in one or two locations in your body, for instance? Hearing, that's right. You can only hear with your ears, okay? What's another one? Yeah, vision. You can only see with your eyes. So again, if I were to shine a flashlight on your kneecap or your belly button, you would have, right, no sensation whatsoever because you don't have photoreceptors there, only your eyes. And smell, because you can only smell with your nose. You can't smell with your fingertips or anything like that. That might be interesting to be able to smell with your fingertips. But it's a special sense, so only one kind of one area in your body. Okay? So here are the special senses. We've got olfaction. And olfaction is a sense of smell. That's one. Vision, your eyes. All right? Let's see. Taste. That is the gustatory sense, gustatory. So, and you can only taste with your tongue, maybe some parts of your throat you have certain receptors for taste. All right, and then hearing, which is your ear. And then there are two more senses that we group into one. Those are called equilibrium senses. So they give your body positional sense in space, like if you're accelerating somehow in space. So they're really accelerometers. You have two kinds of accelerometers for equilibrium sense. So those are the special senses. The equilibrium senses have also to do with your ear, right? So it's only two locations. You can't tell if you're accelerating with your hands or knees or anything, only with your ears.
What about chemoreceptors?
The chemoreceptors. It depends. Chemoreceptors. Those would be general. But they're kind of, it's a good question because, for instance, taste is due to a chemoreceptor. And that's only, so we have to be concerned about what kind of chemoreceptor it is per se. All right, so if you put acid on some part of your body, that's going to stimulate a nociceptor. And those are all over your body. So sometimes chemoreceptors contribute to special sense and sometimes to general sense. So it depends on the application where it's used, okay? Yeah, I hadn't thought of that before, so that's a good question. All right. Okay, what does our next slide look like? All right, still something about receptors in general. And probably this maybe is an old slide to you. Probably you've seen this in lab already. We can break receptors down into two other kinds of categories, and that is how they respond to a stimulus. And the two categories are tonic receptors versus phasic receptors. All right, and tonic receptors respond at a constant rate as long as the stimulus does not change. If the stimulus is applied and is not varied, the frequency of action potentials being sent to the brain is constant. So if we apply the stimulus at this point in time and keep it on at the same intensity for this whole duration and then turn it off, we can see that if it is a threshold stimulus, of course, then it's going to produce action potentials going to the brain. And, of course, you know, an action potential should have a constant amplitude. It shouldn't change. All right. But more importantly, the frequency or the time between these action potentials is not going to change at all if it is a tonic receptor. So once the stimulus is applied, you will always have that perception going to your brain. Okay. Probably a pretty good example of that would be light. Right, because as you're looking around the room right now, the room isn't getting any brighter or dimmer. It's pretty much constant because we're not changing the light. Now, if I were to turn some lights off, of course, then your perception would change. As opposed to a phasic receptors, right? They respond very quickly with a burst of action potentials when the stimulus is applied. And then if the stimulus remains constant, guess what happens to the frequency of action potentials? It decreases. Right, so you become less and less and less aware of this stimulus that's being applied to your body, all right, with a phasic receptor. And some examples of phasic receptors would be, for instance, pressure. and vibration receptors that you have on your integument, because you probably realize as soon as you put your clothes on in the morning, you feel clothes on your body, but what happens after maybe a couple minutes? It doesn't reach your consciousness. You have no idea what clothes are rubbing up against you unless it's providing some kind of painful kind of stimulus, right? So for right now, even, you're not really realizing any information of all the pressure receptors that you're sitting on. But as soon as you sit down, you notice, or you have that sensation of pressure. Those would be examples of basic receptors. Yeah.
So if we're like in a room where there's a certain strong smell, the phasic movement is will start to fade away.
Right. So olfaction is a really good example of the use of phasic receptors. Yeah. And probably taste to some degree too. Yeah. And probably some receptors might have combinations of being tonic and phasic as well. I don't know if there might be some, well, pain, for instance, pain receptors. And pain receptors, if you keep a painful stimulus applied, it will always give your brain the perception of pain, because you should withdraw your body from that stimulus.
So it doesn't like become numb where you can't really feel it
anymore. If there's damage, if the stimulus is such that it damages the receptor or the nerve fiber, then you might be anesthetized to it. Okay, but if it doesn't damage any tissue, you should always have this sense of pain. Yeah.
So could you say that
basic receptors? Oh, hold on 1 second. Another good example of that would be cold. Okay, cold receptors really aren't phasic, but if you cool a cold receptor down so much, when you put ice on something, what happens? It becomes numb, and that's because the temperature is inhibiting the physiology of that receptor. Okay, it's just too cold, yeah. Not necessarily so. It's just, you have to just examine it one by one. Okay. Okay. Smell and touch are good examples of phasic receptors, right? Where we can habituate or adapt to that particular stimulus. We just won't be aware of it. Okay. I want to tell you about the law of specific nerve energies, which just says that stimulation of a sensory fiber evokes only the sensation of that particular modality. And that's because that fiber hooks up to the right location in the brain. Right? So if there are action potentials going to the occipital lobe, that's going to give you visual consciousness. If it goes to the temporal lobe, you're going to hear things, for instance. Right? But here's another term. It's called adequate stimulus. Right, the adequate stimulus has to do with the particular kind of receptor. So all receptors can generate action potentials if stimulated strongly enough, even with a non-ordinary kind of stimulus. So for instance, have you ever hit your head hard enough that you actually saw stars? Okay, probably a couple times. Maybe I'm not the only one, right? So that means that something happened to those cells in the retina that depolarized, and even if you got hit in the head with your eyes closed, you would see stars, right? So the receptors of the retina are going to send action potentials to the occipital lobe. You're going to have a visual experience, but it wasn't really light that was causing it. It's not really hallucination. It was a real event, but it was what? It was trauma, right? It was pressure to the retina. And you black out. I don't know. I'll have to think about that. Okay. I don't know how to explain that one. But maybe I'll wake up in the morning with an explanation. I'm not sure. Okay. Most people black out. When somebody says black out, it has to do with blood flow. Okay. Probably not going to the retina, perhaps, but to the brain. Okay. So if something happens to blood flow to the occipital lobe, then you lose consciousness in that part of the brain, and of course then you won't see anything. But I don't know if that's really what's happening in the circumstance you're thinking about. Okay. All right, so an adequate stimulus is the normal stimulus when applied to a receptor that has the easiest job of stimulating that receptor. That's what we call an adequate stimulus. So, for instance, mechanical receptors respond to mechanical force, but if we apply enough acid to
a mechanoreceptor, it might start to depolarize or send action potentials to the brain as well. So the adequate stimulus is going to be what? Mechanical force, but that can be changed if we apply an above physiologic kind of stimulus to it. Okay, and I gave you an example of photoreceptors. They can respond to trauma as well. Let's see. What's something else that's kind of interesting? Some receptors, like temperature receptors, you have hot receptors and cold receptors in your skin. And the hot receptors send action potentials to the brain when you apply heat to them. But they also send action potentials to the brain when you send cold to them. Right? It's the other way around. Hold on, I got to think about this for a second. Okay, the cold receptors, okay? Cold receptors, they send action potentials to your brain when you put an ice cube on your body. You go, ah, that's cold, okay? But cold receptors have another way of functioning, and that is they can some respond to extremely hot temperatures, not warm temperatures, but hot. Okay, so maybe some of you have stepped in the shower and something happens to the shower and all of a sudden it gets really hot, almost scalding hot, right? And so how does that feel? It might feel hot, but it also feels cold as well. Okay, has anybody ever experienced feeling the sense of cold when you got hot water placed on you? And that's because the cold receptors respond very nicely to cold, but they also have this ability to send action potentials when they get stimulated with a hot temperature. And so that's a paradoxical kind of sensation that you have. All right, so sometimes receptors act a little funny. And the way receptors work is that they can make these generator potentials. All right, so here is another kind of potential that we looked at. So what have we learned so far? Resting membrane potential. We looked at graded potentials due to ligand-gated channels. We looked at action potentials due to sodium and potassium channels opening and closing. Here's another kind of potential. We call this a generator potential. And a generator potential is something that is generated by a receptor cell of some kind. And these will produce EPSPs. And the intensity of the EPSP or the height of the EPSP is going to be directly related to the stimulus strength. And the stimulus strength has to be sufficient so that the generator potential reaches threshold, and then that will cause an action potential on a neuron that will take that information to the brain. All right, so you can have sub-threshold generator potentials, in which case then you won't have the perception of anything happening, for instance, on the surface of your body. Okay, so they're proportional to the stimulus intensity. After threshold is reached, action potential is sent to the brain, and of course, the intensity, the intensity, if this generator potential, right, persisted for a long period of time, then frequency coding would be used to code the intensity of the stimulus, and your brain would understand the intensity of that generator potential as what, an increase or a decrease in frequency of action potentials in some region of your brain. All right, except for phasic receptors, right? The generator potential adapts very quickly to a constant stimulus and then quickly diminishes. So phasic response is not due to fatigue within the neuron or neurotransmitter across the neuromuscular junction. That's a property of the receptor itself. Yeah. Is there spatial? Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's definitely spatial summation involved.
So how would that work with applying more intensity to the
brain? Mm-hmm. Well, for instance, there could be many receptors that synapse on one neuron, right? So let's see if I can draw this out right here. So here's a neuron taking information to the brain. And let's just say, right, that here are a number of receptors, okay? And if we apply pressure to this whole area right here, all of these receptors are going to be sending information to this one neuron. Okay, so in this particular case, as opposed to, let's just say, one receptor sending information to the brain, and if the threshold stimulus for this neuron right here is maybe a stimulus of this height right here, all right, what does that stimulus intensity have to be in order to generate an action potential here? Basically what? Just a quarter of the height. All right, so if that's the intensity of the stimulus, then all of these generator potentials will summate here, and that's going to send an action potential to the brain. Okay, so this neuron doesn't need the same stimulus intensity to trigger an action potential, but now the other difference is the receptive area. All right, so now you have very fine discriminative ability to tell where the stimulus is being applied to your body. This is four times coarser, but it is what? Four times more sensitive. So there's usually a trade-off between receptive area and sensitivity. All right, so for instance, in this case over here, there might be another receptor with another neuron going. All right, so now your mind can tell where that stimulus is being applied, whether it's here or here, right? But you need a higher intensity. If it's this circumstance, your mind can't tell if the stimulus was applied here or here or here or here. Okay, so that's the receptive area for an applied stimulus. Okay, and then depending on the intensity of a generator potential, you can see that again, frequency encoding is used to relate the stimulus intensity to the brain, right? Because when you have the highest stimulus right here, which causes the highest generator potential, this generator potential is strong enough to overcome the relative refractory period of an action potential, and so action potentials can be generated at a quicker pace as the stimulus intensity increases. Okay, special senses. All right, so special senses, what are special senses again? Okay. You could tell me some examples like vision, smell, hearing, but they are senses that you have the ability to detect in one or two locations on your body. That's one way of thinking about it. And a special sense also requires a very sophisticated kind of organ to receive that information and transmit it to the brain. So, for instance, for light, it's just not a free nerve ending like you have for pain all over your body. You have a very specialized organ like your eye, your eyeball, okay, and accessory structures that are associated with vision as well. All right, so special senses, only one or two locations, and they also require very specialized kinds of organs. Okay, taste and smell. Taste and smell are exteroreceptors because they respond to chemicals of the external environment as opposed to interoceptors, which respond to chemicals deep inside your body, like glucose receptors, for instance, in the pancreas, or pH receptors or CO2 receptors in your body. All right, so the first one I want to talk about is the sense of gustation, which is the sense of taste. And this is the organ right here that allows you to taste things. And this is what we call a taste bud. And a taste bud, you might open up your anatomy book, a taste bud is a microscopic structure because guess what this thing is right here? What is this thing right here? So if you look in a mirror and you stick your tongue out, could you see this thing right here? No, because it is that's a cell, right? You need what do you need to see a cell? A microscope. So to see a taste bud, for instance, bless you, in order to see a taste bud, you need a microscope. So these are microscopic structures. But usually there is a grouping of taste buds on something that commonly we call taste buds. Those are the things that you can actually see on your tongue, but those are really what? Those are really papillae. So a papilla is lined with taste buds. All right, so here are the taste cells or gustatory cells, and you can see that it has a couple little projections that sort of look like hairs, or you could think of them as cilia projecting off of the surface of these cells. And these are what are going to generate these generator potentials, which then are going to stimulate this sensory nerve fiber, which is going to take action potentials to the gustatory cortex. All right, so taste receptor cells are modified epithelial cells. You have maybe as many as 100 in one taste bud, and each bud can respond to all categories of tastants or tastant kinds of molecules. So a taste bud is not going to just be responsible for one kind of taste. So here are some of the tastes that we can perceive, and there's always a lot of discussion if how many tastes we can taste and if we're categorizing them correctly, but this is probably a pretty good list to start with. What we can taste are things that are sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and umami is the sense of deliciousness, right? So it's a very pleasing kind of taste. It evokes a sense of pleasantness, and a chemical that stimulates umami receptors are glutamate or glutamic acid, right? And you find that in your food in the form of monosodium glutamate, right? So that's why it's placed in food, so that enhances the flavor or your sense of deliciousness when you eat them. All right, so here is a taste cell right here, and here you can see the hairs poking off of it. So salt, so if you're going to have the sensation of salt, what would you have to eat? Like table salt, yeah, like salt. Okay, and what is salt, table salt? It is just sodium and chloride, right, put together. And we're familiar with sodium, and you could tell me the atomic structure and all that and with salt. And it just so happens that the receptor cells, the taste cells for salt, have sodium channels in the hairs right here. And so when you put a lot of salt in your mouth, guess what happens? What happens to the concentration of sodium in your mouth or around these taste cells? Well, it skyrockets, right? And then since the sodium channel is open, it diffuses into this taste cell right here. And what does it do to the electrical potential on this particular cell? It causes depolarization, which is basically what? That's an EPSP, right? And that flows through the whole cell. When the membrane potential changes down over here toward the basal region of the cell, these are voltage-gated calcium channels, and they open up. That allows calcium to enter the cell. And remember, calcium is an important signaling molecule that's used for translocating these vesicles that contain neurotransmitter. They move to the cell membrane, and that neurotransmitter is exocytosed, moves across the synapse, and it produces EPSPs in the sensory neuron, which then causes action potentials which go to the brain. Okay, in particular the gustatory cortex of the brain, and you have the perception of salty as a result of that. Okay, just because when you eat salt, that causes depolarization of the cell. All right, does that seem hard to understand? No, that seems actually pretty simple how that works, right? Pretty handy. Okay, sour. The taste of sour, on the other hand, is really a taste of acid. So when you eat acidic things, all right, you'll have the taste of sour. Like what's an acid that we have in our diet that is sour? What's a really good example? Like lime or lemon, right? That's citric acid. Or maybe salad dressing vinegar is acetic acid. All right, so on these kinds of receptor cells, all right, now instead of having sodium channels, they're going to have proton channels, hydrogen ion channels. So when the concentration of acid increases around that particular taste bud, this hydrogen ion enters the cell down its concentration gradient, and of course that's going to change the membrane potential. How is it going to change the membrane potential? It's going to depolarize it. That depolarization, when it reaches this end of the cell, it's going to then cause these calcium channels to open, which is going to cause fusion and exocytosis of excitatory neurotransmitter. That's going to cause graded potentials on this sensory neuron, and if it reaches threshold, of course, action potentials, which then are taken to the brain for your perception of what? Sour taste. All right, so just due to these proton channels. Now, these figures I don't think you have in your book. You probably have something similar, but not exactly. Do you have exactly in there? Oh, you do have exactly like that. Never mind. I thought I stole them from someplace else. Good, they're in your book. Okay. All right, so that's two of the four senses. All right, sweet and umami are a little bit different. They're not just channels that are open all the time. All right, these are G-protein coupled receptors. Ah, so was it a good idea to learn something about G-protein coupled receptors way back when? Yeah, because your body uses them all the time. All right, so for sweet and umami, a molecule has to bind to the receptor. That's going to activate G-proteins. Right, they're going to dissociate. And that's going to cause the buildup of a second messenger inside the cell, right? And of course, the shape of this receptor right here has got to match the shape of the ligand molecule, right? So glutamic acid is going to have a different shape than, say, glucose is, right? So they're going to be selectively stimulated by either one of these things right here. And the second messenger is going to then eventually close potassium channels. So when if a potassium channel closes, what does that produce in terms of membrane potential? Depolarization. Yeah, depolarization. Right? If you keep these potassium channels open, that's going to keep the membrane hyperpolarized. Right? But when they close, that's going to cause depolarization. Yeah. So the first messenger is going to be some kind of tastant molecule. For instance, maybe like glucose, yeah? And another one, since we're talking about umami right here, would also be glutamate or glutamic acid, which is an amino acid. So the receptor is going to have the shape or the complementary shape to glutamate. Yeah, so that's the first messenger. And the second messenger, I'm not telling you which one it is. Okay, just say second messenger. All right, and there's something else, unfortunately, that I'm not telling you, but it's too much. And that is, what, the neurotransmitter. I don't know if you maybe want to do a Wikipedia and see if anybody knows what these neurotransmitters are, but what I want you to know is that they are excitatory neurotransmitters, which cause EPSPs on these afferent neurons right here, okay, which then send action potentials to the brain. Okay, and bitter, a good example of a bitter kind of molecule would be quinine. That's something you could experience in tonic water, for instance. Right, that's going to bind to a receptor, and that's a G-protein coupled receptor. It works through a second messenger. And in this particular case, this second messenger is going to cause the release of calcium from endoplasmic reticulum. We're going to see how this motif works in another kind of cell pretty soon. That calcium signal is then going to activate various proteins, which will cause the fusion and release of neurotransmitter from this cell right here. And that's going to cause EPSPs, and then action potentials on this sensory neuron right here. All right, so that's how we perceive taste. And of course, these signals go to the particular place on your cerebral cortex for these modalities. Okay, the sense of smell, olfaction. Right, that's a special sense because you could only smell with your nose. And you probably were really interested in this when you took anatomy because what bone is this right here? That is the, okay, it is the ethmoid bone. I don't know if somebody said ethmoid or not. The ethmoid bone has these olfactory foramina in the cribriform plate. And these olfactory nerves, right, actually go right through the cribriform plate into your nasal cavity. And this is the only place in your body, for sure, that I'm aware of, and probably this is 100% true, this is the only place in your body where you actually have nervous tissue that's dangling outside your body. Okay, it's not surrounded by the integument that's being protected or anything else. But this is also another interesting area, so let's zoom over here. Here's that cribriform plate of the ethmoid bone. And anybody recognize what kind of nerve cell type this looks like right here? Does that look like a unipolar or a multipolar? This is kind of a blast from the past. It's what, a bipolar neuron? And when we take anatomy, we said that there are only a couple places that have bipolar neurons, and they're always associated with special senses. So here's a good example. For olfaction, we have bipolar neurons. All right, we also have, so these are the receptor neurons. We also have other epithelial cells, right, interspersed between the bipolar neurons. And these, some of these cells are actually stem cells. So in general, what can you tell me about neurons? Do they regenerate? Or once they're damaged, do they have a tendency just to die and then you're deficient that particular modality? They're what? Yeah. Usually we know neurons to not be able to regenerate. But in this location right here, that's not really true. All right, these bipolar neurons regenerate, I believe, about every 2 weeks or so. Because what is the environment right here? It is, I don't know, wherever you are, that's the environment, right? They're just in the outside world. So they have a pretty hard lifetime. And so they die frequently, but they're replaced by the stem cells, okay, of the epithelium. All right, so I find that really fascinating because what might you use these neural stem cells for? Maybe if you would like to rebuild somebody's spinal cord. Wouldn't it be nice? Here's a person has stem cells, neuronal stem cells. Maybe you could take these and train them into becoming a multipolar neuron, transplant them into somebody's spinal cord, and they can regain the function of their spinal cord again. That would be really fascinating. Okay, and maybe someday somebody will learn how to do that. Okay, and the other nice thing then is that you don't need cells from somebody else to do that, like maybe an embryo or something. So what's the advantage of using an autograft, right, cells from your own body as opposed to getting a graft or cells from somebody else's body? There's no rejection, right? So the medical procedure is a lot easier if you can rebuild your body with your own cells as opposed to somebody else's cells, right? Which will be always, your body will always try to reject them. All right, so again, what do we see? The receptor cells have these cilia on them. Okay, and then they send depolarizing signals to the mitral cells, which then send signals to the olfactory cortex of the brain. Okay, so you have the receptor cells, the supporting cells, and the basal cells. The basal cells are those stem cells, and the other supporting cells in the epithelium are just important because they contain detoxifying enzymes that try to maintain the health of the epithelium right here. All right, well, for the sense of taste, we had five, what we say, primary senses. What were the five primary? We had sweet and salty, sour, all right, sour, which is acidic, bitter, and umami. Well, there's quite a bit of discussion if there are primary senses for olfaction. And nobody can agree on this, and there are probably thousands, and it might even be different from one person to another person. So I can't tell you what the primary senses of smell are, but a couple of them would be etheric or musky, flowery, for instance, and we just have thousands of different kinds of receptors for different shapes of molecules in our nose. All right, so the gene family for these different receptor types as well, it's humongous. We might have thousands of different kinds of receptors for smell. But in any case, it's going to be acting through a G-protein kind of receptor, and when an odorant molecule binds to that receptor, that's going to cause action potentials going to that particular part of the brain. All right, ears and hearing. Ears and hearing, is that a special or general sense? That's a special sense because you only have two ears. So if we look way deep inside your ear, we're going to see a structure that looks like this. This is what we call the vestibular apparatus. Now, where is this thing located? What bone? That's going to be, yeah, your temporal bone. And in particular, remember the petrous region of the temporal bone. That's a region between the external auditory meatus and the internal auditory meatus. This is where the vestibular apparatus is located. And this vestibular apparatus is important because it contributes to three senses, two that are kind of similar, the third is pretty different. It provides you the sense of equilibrium. The part that gives you the sense of equilibrium is right here. It contains the vestibule, which is right over here, and inside the vestibule we have maculae, and there's two different kinds, there's the utricle and saccule. This gives you a sense of linear acceleration, while the semicircular canals right up over here give us the sense of rotational acceleration, or twisting, or turning. Okay, and then this part right here, this is what we call the cochlea, and this is the organ that gives us the sense of hearing. So in the ear, we have hearing, and we also have equilibrium. All right, so let's take a look at this. Oh, this one right here, we see the auditory nerve, and then the vestibular nerve. Right, auditory nerve goes to the cochlea, so what kind of, well, it says right here, auditory information is passed on the auditory nerve. And sometimes it's called the cochlear nerve because it goes to the cochlea. And this is the vestibular nerve. It forms one nerve, and that's what we call the vestibulocochlear nerve, right? That's one of the cranial nerves. All right, and this is that makes up your inner ear. All right, so let's take a little bit more look. All right, so there's a fluid inside the vestibular apparatus that we call endolymph. So here we can see an outline of the endolymph right here. It fills the semicircular canals as well as the vestibule and parts of the cochlea. And what does the cochlea remind you of? It kind of reminds you of a snail. So actually what I want you to do sometime, in your mind anyway, is to unroll this thing, right? And if you unroll this, it becomes very, very long, right? And that's why it's rolled up, because you don't have space inside your temporal bone for this thing to exist, all stretched out. So what has evolution figured out how to do to take something large and put it in a small space? Yeah, fold it up. In this particular case, it's really nice. It doesn't fold it up. It actually rolls it up really nice and neatly. Okay. Okay, the bony labyrinth. There is the cochlea. It has a bony outer shell as well as the vestibule and the semicircular canals. And inside the bony labyrinth, you have the membranous labyrinth with the endolymph inside of it. Okay, linear acceleration. We get the sense from the utricle and saccule. The utricle gives us the sense of linear acceleration in a vertical direction. And the saccule right here gives us a sense of linear acceleration in a horizontal direction. So for instance, if you're sitting in a car and you step on the accelerator, you understand that you're accelerating, and it is the saccule right here that is sending information to the brain. But for instance, when you're in an elevator and you start to go up and down, you have the sense coming from the utricle of accelerating in that direction, the vertical direction. So the organs in the utricle and saccule are very similar. They're called maculae. So the maculae are the organs for sensing linear acceleration. The organs for sensing angular acceleration or circular acceleration from the semicircular canals are what we call the crista ampullaris. Right, so you can see at the base of every semicircular canal there's a swelling right here. And somebody said, what's a fancy name for a swelling or a vial? Sometimes we call it a ampule, right? And so these reminded somebody of a little bottle. And so these are called the ampules of the semicircular canals. And inside the ampules, you have the crista ampullaris, which are the sense organs for angular acceleration. So how does the sense of equilibrium develop? Okay. Well, there are cells in the crista ampullaris, that's in the semicircular canals, and the maculae, that's in the utricle and saccule, that have these projections. We call these stereocilia. And here are the receptor cells that can sense acceleration. So since it has these projections off of them, they're actually called hair cells, but they don't have hairs growing out of them. They have these cilia coming out of them, but they reminded somebody of hair when they first looked at them. Right? So for both the sense of angular acceleration and linear acceleration, I haven't defined this for you, so let me write this down. Okay, sometimes we call linear acceleration static equilibrium. All right, and the sense, so this is linear acceleration. And the second one is kinetic. Equilibrium. All right, so this is circular acceleration. And what gives us a sense of that? The static equilibrium is in the maculae. And linear acceleration, okay, are going to be the semicircular canals. So this is how these organs are put together. They're made up of hair cells. And they have mechanoreceptors in these cilia right here. So if they're bent one direction, that opens up sodium channels, right, which causes EPSPs, which generate a lot of action potentials. If they bend the other way, those sodium channels close, right, which then inhibits the cell and it produces a much decreased frequency in action potentials going to the brain. Okay, so it doesn't really matter. The only thing that your brain understands is what? It doesn't really understand taste or smell. It only understands what? Action potentials. And the intensity is coded by the frequency of action potentials. And then you'll have the perception of a particular modality just by the area of the brain that's being stimulated by these action potentials. All right, so how does this system work? Okay. All right, so for instance, in the maculae, all right, so remember the maculae is in the vestibule, which is the center part of the vestibular apparatus. Should I flip back a couple slides real quick? I'll close your eyes. All right, so here's the vestibule. Here's the utricle, here's the saccule. So let's just pay attention to this area right here. So I said there's going to be hair cells in this area that make up the maculae. All right, so here we are. All right, so here is the maculae. Here are the hair cells, right here and right here, right here. And where the hell the hair is projecting? They're projecting vertically up into this gelatinous mass. So it's a little like jello right here. And then sitting on top of the jello, we have otoliths. And otoliths are crystals of calcium carbonate, and they're heavy. So how do they react to gravity? Gravity is going to pull on them because they're heavy. They're like little weights. So you have these little crystals that are growing right on the top, little crystal garden right on the top of this gelatinous mass. So when you change your head position, for instance, when you look down, what's going to happen? These otoliths are going to pull on this gelatinous mass, deform the gelatinous mass, and then it's going to deform the stereocilia, and it's going to then change the rate of action potentials that are going to the brain as a result of that. All right, so this is important for just linear acceleration. Or for instance, what's another way to stimulate this? Well, here's a person who's maybe sitting in a car, and when you start to accelerate the car, that's going to bend these stereocilia one way, and then as you stop the car, they're going to bend the other way, and you're going to have that sense. All right, so, and the other thing that this shows, which we don't talk about in here, and that is the force of gravity. Now, this person isn't moving. She's just changing her head position, but gravity acts like acceleration to us. All right, so right now I'm standing on the ground like this, but where do I feel pressure on my body? On the bottoms of my feet, right? And that's exactly the same kind of force I would feel, for instance, if I'm sitting in the car leaning up against the back seat, right? And if the car is not accelerating, I don't really feel much on my back, but if all of a sudden I start accelerating forward, what about the pressure on my back? It goes way up, right? All right, so gravity acts like acceleration. So that's why when you change your head position, and it changes it in just a linear way. Yeah. Oh, I don't have a sign-in sheet. That's a good question. It's probably too late for a sign-in sheet. All right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, there could be a couple of things going on there. For instance, if you're driving on a mountain road and all of a sudden you're getting a little motion sickness, for instance. When people go up in higher altitudes, right, there's less oxygen up there, and they might actually get a little high altitude sickness. Okay, so that's one thing that might happen, and that usually mostly produces a headache. I don't know if it produces nausea. Right, but if, for instance, if you're driving in a car, irregardless if it's up in the mountains and if it's a twisty, turny road, you might actually experience motion sickness as a result of that, right, which is going to produce nausea. And that's due to the accelerometers that are in your ear that are experience all the twisting and turning, and the experience that you have with your eyes isn't matching up with your ears. And that gives you a sense of that disequilibrium that produces nausea. So it could be maybe a combined effect of both of those things. So if you have nausea and a headache, it's probably a little altitude sickness with a little motion sickness on top of it. Well, they always say it's best to look at something that's fixed, a fixed object. Okay, but you know that doesn't always work, because if you're in a car that's moving, and if you're holding a book, the book is fixed. Well, that's a sure way to produce motion sickness. All right, so I guess a fixed object would be something outside the car, like maybe a mountain or something that isn't changing, and just kind of follow it along. And then that will have a tendency to justify or rectify your experiences between your inner ear and what you're seeing, and that might have a beneficial effect. Okay. So that's kind of all I know about that, except the drugs that you should take to prevent it. Okay, there's some pretty good drugs. Like scopolamine is a good one, that kind of drug, right? Or Dramamine is probably okay, Meclizine, if people have problems with motion sickness. But these are the organs that help produce motion sickness, right? The maculae of the utricle and saccule, and the crista ampullaris of the semicircular canals. All right, so let's turn our attention to the semicircular canals, and the semicircular canals are there for circular or angular acceleration, and we call that the sense of what? Kinetic equilibrium. All right, now there is a fluid, of course, the endolymph, filling all of these different spaces right here. And this fluid has a property of inertia. And that is, what is inertia? Well, inertia means that if this fluid is stationary, it's going to have a tendency to remain stationary. It has a tendency not to want to move. Or if this fluid is moving, if it is flowing, it's going to have a tendency to stay in that motion that's flowing around. So how can fluid in this semicircular canal flow? It can flow in a loop, right, in a circle. And this fluid in this semicircular canal can flow in a circle as well. So that's why the sense of kinetic equilibrium has to do with angular acceleration due to the structure of the semicircular canals. So let me demonstrate, give me your notes real quick. Let me demonstrate inertia. Or just that one right there. Yeah, I just need a quick piece of paper. All right, so I said inertia is what? If a fluid is, or if an object is stationary, what does it have a tendency to do? To stay stationary, right? So let's say that the fluid inside my drink right here is endolymph, right? And I can move this paper without making this fluid move because the fluid has inertia, right? So if I pull real fast, ooh, that was really close. I almost knocked it over, all right? And so I just demonstrated inertia, right? I can move the piece of paper and the fluid is just going to stay there. All right. What is another effect of inertia? Is if something is in motion and it's going to have a tendency to stay in motion. So if I move the piece of paper and I stop the piece of paper, what does that fluid want to do? It wants to keep moving, right? So can I knock it over pretty easily? Yeah, that's real easy. So that's inertia, and I didn't even get your notes wet, okay? So think of endolymph as being in that bottle right there, all right? But we have to know something about the structure of the crista ampullaris to know how that goes. And guess what? We're going to have to come back next week But you could read ahead a little bit about angular acceleration and these angular accelerometers that you have in your head and how they work. And then the last thing we got to talk about is vision in this chapter.